You own the customer experience when you have their data. You have the ability to communicate a message in front of them. So if you've got the email list and you send them over to Amazon, Amazon rewards that.
Sure.
And your conversion rate's probably going to be higher sending them to Amazon than sending them to your Shopify store.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Hey folks, it's Joe Valley from Quiet Light Brokerage. And today I've got somebody that a lot of you might know already. His name is Ryan Daniel Moran. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Joe, thanks so much for having me, man. Let's make some magic.
Listen, I was having a barbecue last night. We had some friends over, and this is an absolute true story. And one of them is an entrepreneur wannabe. She's in the corporate world and she bought some Amazon products and she tried something and it didn't work, but she's going to go at it again someday. And she's grilling me. She always asks me how things are with Quiet Light Brokerage. And she starts asking about the podcast. I said, yeah, you know, we're doing all right. Hey, have you ever talked to Ryan Daniel Moran? Just like that. And here you are today and we're talking to you. You're kind of a little celebrity, I shouldn't say little. You're kind of a celebrity, a rock star maybe for this. Look, it was a 50-year-old woman. She's rather attractive and she knows who you are. And she,
well, you know, it's funny because my ideal market is attractive 50-year-old women. We all know that that's the market I'm after right now. So perfect. Tell her to give me, maybe call me maybe.
She loves listening and the fact that you're first and foremost helping people. That's what she loves about it. She says someday she's going to get back to it, but she loves listening and she's going to take that leap at some point in the future. So good for you. Hey, listen, as I said prior to the intro, we don't do fancy intros. So if you would, I know it's hard to talk about yourself, but give folks a little bit of background about yourself, who you are, where you came from, what you're all about.
Yeah, I invest in and I start physical products brands. And the way that I got to that point was actually as a pastoral student back in 2006. I built my first website, started my first business in between high school and college on my shared dial-up computer in my living room and hand-coded websites using raw HTML in a software program called Dreamweaver, if you are old enough to remember Dreamweaver.
I know it well.
So what's funny is, you know, we hear a lot of people who are talking about building and or selling businesses, thinking about the good old, either like all the opportunities gone now or the good old days, how they used to be. Man, I was hand coding websites in Dreamweaver on a dial-up computer. Do you realize how much more opportunity we have now being able to build websites on platforms and sell products on Amazon? So the opportunities are way, way bigger now, but I was just trying to find a way to supplement my what I expected to be $30,000 a year salary as a pastor. Now, fast forward a few years, I did not finish the pastoral route for reasons that would be probably best left on a second podcast that you have, Joe, that's maybe called Quiet Skepticism.
Yeah, something about where we're helping people, we're guiding them off that path, right?
Exactly. Quiet, go to the light, we'll call it. And I did not finish that route, and I became a full-time entrepreneur. So I was really involved in the internet marketing space for many years until I really decided or realized I hated that crowd. I didn't like hanging out with those people. So why was I going to conferences where those people hung out? And I took the skill set that I had from search engine optimization, from pay-per-click marketing, from email copywriting, and I applied it to physical products brands. And I've had a couple different exits in the physical products world. And now I'm an investor in physical products businesses because it's what I know. It's who I can help the most. And I think it's where the biggest upside is in the market right now, whether you are selling or building a business or buying a business. I think there's a tremendous amount of white space with the transition from big brands into more what I call micro brands, mostly internet based. That's where I see the biggest opportunities right now. So that's I've had a couple exits that have totaled a little bit over eight figures in cash exchange. I still own a minority stake in a few of those businesses and have a portfolio of businesses, but my primary focus is investing in physical products brands, and I have a media company for entrepreneurs at capitalism.com.
Okay. So when it comes to investing, people look at buy versus build. In fact, we had a podcast recently with our newest broker, Walker Dybel, who wrote about a book called Buy versus Build. And there's a really long subtitle. And it was it quickly rocketed to the top 10 podcasts that we have. And you're talking about investing. Do you think it's better to buy versus build at this point in your career? Or would you recommend somebody that's just starting out to scrape some dollars together and bootstrap something and start?
Yeah, it's better for me to invest, but it wasn't better for me 5 years ago. In 2013, when I took my first sale on Amazon.com for a physical product, I had no business investing in physical products brands. I had no business buying physical products brands. Now, back then, I was buying a lot of websites. And you know what I was buying, Joe? I was buying search engine friendly websites with email lists. Social media followings weren't as big back then, but with audiences, followings, in a target niche market that sold affiliate products, because that was what I knew.
That's what you knew.
I work with a lot of people who are like looking for the system, and you are the system. You are the machine, and your machine is unique to you. So applying your machine to different opportunities is where value is created. So for me, I'm at this point, I have more upside as an investor because I already have all the retail connections. I have the connections to sell businesses. I'm connected to other investors. That's my own skill set. But the entrepreneur who I invest in is way better suited to start that company than I am. And that's what capitalism is, right? Like, it's the value that I bring in combination with the value that you bring. And when we bring them together, it's greater than the sum of our parts. And so for me, yeah, I have more value as an investor, but to say like it's better, I think would be a mistake.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It depends upon the individual situation, without a doubt. I've bought and I've sold and I've invested as well. And I can say each were successful in their own way, and each were very, very difficult in their own ways as well. You learn along the way from the mistakes mostly.
If I could, Joe, I will add though, like globally, I think we're in a seller's market. I think if we're looking at buying versus selling, if it's a binary choice, I do think we're in a seller's market right now.
I have to agree with you 100%. When we have a good quality listing, I had a conversation with someone this morning, who wants to buy, and he's a referral from somebody who already bought, and says, this guy's doing great, so I want to do what he's doing. And the response is, look, when a great listing comes along, you need to be prepared. So the more listings you look at, the more you're going to know the right fit when it comes along, and you need to be able to act fast because you and a dozen other people are doing the same thing and are going to make an offer on that business. So I agree, it's a seller's market. But at the same time, the multiples still don't get pushed too high. It's still the buyers who decide that. You and I, as sellers, as brokers, can pick whatever number we think the value of the business is, but we don't make the final decision. At the end, it's usually the buyer. The seller's got a lot to say about it because they can say yes or no, but it's still the buyer makes the decision in terms of the value for the most part. But you just recently, you said you've exited a couple of different times in the last few years. What did you learn in that process? If you look at the exit, or maybe, do you want to talk about the fact, the mistakes you made, maybe building, and what you can do to help the entrepreneurs that are listening, or perhaps the exit, and maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, well, there's one thing in particular that I think was a mistake, if you will, and it was thinking that the buyer had all of the control. By the way, this is C Money back here. He's the one who makes me look great on the internet.
For those listening and not watching, somebody just walked into the background.
Yeah, so the mistake that I made was thinking that the buyer had all of the control. And if I could redo this, Joe, the truth is, if you've built something, if you've built a business, like, you're the one with the asset. Like, you're the one with the goods. Like, money is chasing you. People want to buy you. And so often the seller comes into the market and is like, the thing that I'm after is the check. Right. And I'm hoping that I get the check, and that immediately puts you in the frame in which you're the asker. You're the one who is not in the power position. So somebody shows up with an offer, and the seller is like, thank you, please, oh, please, Mr. Money Pants, I would like your money. And now they're in the position to beat you up over earnings, over in the negotiation. So what I wish I had done was recognize the fact that I'm the one with the goods. I'm the one with the asset that people want. I'm the one courting the offers. People are making offers to me. They want what I got, not the other way around. So if you're in that position, you're willing to say no, and you combine that with a term sheet that says, here's what I'm looking for. That to me puts the seller in the frame of mind where they're in the negotiating position. I didn't do that. I discovered that after the fact. And I really could only have learned that by going through the process. I personally learned by making mistakes and paying for them later.
We all do.
But that's a mistake that I wish somebody had told me before I went to market.
Was the buyer that you're referring to, is it a strategic buyer, or did you have your business officially listed and people came to you?
Yeah, we had it listed and we were acquired by an equity group. I still own a minority stake in that company. I'm on great terms with the equity group. We're really happy with the buyer. Have become friends and obviously business partners at this point. But had I gone to market with terms that I wanted, I probably would have ended up in a more favorable financial position when it came to close date.
Well, the next time you have a transaction, you'll know that and you'll be able to make adjustments. And
right.
Really, I think, like you said, the check isn't the end all. It's more about, I think almost in many ways, what your next adventure is going to be. Hmm. I know that a lot of folks that I work with, and myself included, when I exited, I sold too late. I was emotionally tired. And I think that's the absolute wrong time to sell. You should sell. You should plan to sell. Just don't wake up and decide to sell. But when you're emotionally tired, you're not doing everything that you can to maximize the profits of the business. And that's going to drive down the value. And you're going to get beat up at the end if you're so committed to that check that you can't negotiate a little bit more for something else and be willing to walk away from that buyer if they're not a good buyer. And correct me if I'm wrong, but just tell me how you think here. I always find that it makes an enormous difference if you like the person that's buying your business or the one if you're buying a business from. It's not just about the check. It's not just about the money. It's the people you're doing business with. And I think that as a seller, you can get more value if you're respected and professional and likable. And the same as a buyer. If you're a buyer and you're professional and likable and compliment the owner on the business that they built, that you're going to get a better transaction out of it versus old hardcore Wall Street negotiations. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know if you are right or wrong because I intentionally don't do business with people that I don't like.
So therefore, anybody that wants to buy a business from you, if you don't like them, then you got to work with somebody you like. Classic.
I don't think everybody has that mentality though. I think I would even go as far as to say the majority of people are buying and selling based on numbers or the deal. And very few entrepreneurs get behind every purchase as a person. And so I think most people are approaching it by numbers and logically rather than is there a connection here? Now, I personally, just like from the protection of my own lifestyle, am willing to say no to anything that I personally don't like. And what that does is it always puts me in a strong negotiating position because if I don't like somebody, I have no problem walking away. And the person who is most willing to walk usually has the upper hand in the negotiation.
I agree 100%. I find that from a buyer's perspective, one of the questions I get a lot from buyers when I'm up on a panel or speaking or something like this is, how do I negotiate up against an all-cash buyer, somebody that's got more money than me? And the tried and true answer is be likable. It's you don't necessarily have to have more cash to get the deal done. And a classic example is, I sold a business last fall. It was about $2.5 million. And the guy had two full price offers within the first 10 days. One was from an all cash buyer who was a little rough around the edges and was hard to work with. The other was from a really likable guy who was buying with an SBA loan and actually required 10% seller financing in that. Mm-hmm. The entrepreneur, the seller of this business had the choice. He could go for the all cash or he can go for the guy that he liked. He actually chose the full price SBA buyer and chose to carry a 10% seller note versus working with somebody that he didn't like. So in that situation, I think it makes a difference in terms of buyers that are listening. Be likable. If you're working with a broker, you absolutely have to be likable, because they're, as you said, it's more of a seller's market. And there's a lot of buyers out there. There are buyers that are competing for that same business. And when they're likable, they're going to build rapport. And when you build rapport, you sometimes learn about things before they hit the market as well. Ryan, talk to me about some of the mistakes you've made in your own business. Maybe two or three of the biggest mistakes that come off the top of your head. Looking back and learning, damn, I screwed that up. If I ever do that again, I'm going to do it a different way.
Anything? Well, every time I've made a mistake, it was because I was playing the short term. So when I have made short-term decisions, I usually make bad decisions. I like to say that the longer term that I can make decisions, the wiser I am and the better decisions that I make. I said before that people forget that behind every purchase is a person. That goes for customers too. And all relationships are long-term relationships, or the best relationships are long-term relationships. So if you're aware that behind every transaction is a person, and you play it like it's a long-term relationship, you end up building a better company. Sometimes, in spite of a short-term decision, meaning, for example, like as we're recording this, there's in the Amazon world, there's this thing we're calling review gate, where Amazon is coming in and hitting a bunch of businesses and removing their reviews. Mm-hmm. And it's been a bloodbath. It's been just an absolute bloodbath. And the people who are soaring through it are the people who have been doing the right things the right way for the longest. And the people who are being hurt the most are the people who are the most profitable over the last couple of years, because they played the tactic game. And like, there's absolutely room for tactics inside of every business, but those who have been building really solid brands and building audiences and building followings, they're going to soar right through this and capture a whole heck of a lot of market share. So the mistakes that I've made were always saying, what's the Band-Aid solution here, rather than building for the long term. So we take a rule now in the business that we're building. We say, okay, here's the situation what we're in. Rather than talk about how we're going to fix it, let's say, what do we wish we had started doing 90 days ago? And that would have made today a lot easier to get through. That's the decision that we need to make today, which is a really hard conversation to have when you're in reaction mode. But we force ourselves to ask that question, because it usually addresses whatever the root cause is that we need to fix, rather than going for Band-Aid solutions. So that'd be mistake number one. Mistake number two would be as a leader, telling people what to do. There's a great book called Multipliers that really warped my brain in terms of how I can effectively lead people. And what I realized after reading that book was that I had been diminishing the talent on my teams by telling people what I wanted them to do, rather than casting a vision and inviting people to build their piece of that. Now, that seems kind of nuanced and maybe overly simplistic, but I couldn't emphasize enough the accountability that this book brought me on how much I was diminishing the people that I was working with, and the difference in energy and growth that happened once I started correcting those issues. So as an entrepreneur, we often have like our baby that we're bringing to our team, and we're telling people how to build the baby. When in reality, if we're working with smart people, they probably own their area of expertise better than we can, even if we can't see it. And the big distinction that book highlights is someone who diminishes their team is usually the smartest person in the room. But a real leader makes the rest of the team feel like they're the smartest person in the room. And that was a huge shift for my overall happiness and for the growth of my companies. And it's something that I wish that I had done before I was building companies to sell them.
What kind of staffing do you have, just out of curiosity?
Well, the company that I just exited was a team of four. The portfolio of companies, of brands that I have, is a team of five. And my media company, capitalism.com, is a team of six.
And are all of those people in-house, or do you do some... are they VAs, or are they working remotely, or they come to the office every day?
I'm only counting in-house people, so that does not count freelancers. But no, not everybody. We're a distributed team. So like, I'm recording this in my office right now. One of my team members is right here by my side, but people will come in and out. Some people, like, we have a team member in Canada, we have a team member in Germany, but they're all full-time dedicated to
more. Okay, good. I asked that because, you know, most people that are listening would probably be considered lifestyle entrepreneurs, and they have outsourced staff and VAs and people working remotely. So it's good to know that, even though they're not coming into your office every day, which is really important. All right. So we've got the short-term vision. Don't have that. Long-term vision, so that you don't have major stomach aches with algorithm updates or review gates in this situation. And then over managing of the staff, you know, let them be their experts. Anything else that comes to mind?
As far as big mistakes that I've made, I mean, we talked about the mistake in selling. As far as building the business go, I'll say, I wish that I had spent more money on cold advertising. Like, always. Like, there's never been a business where I was like, I think I spent too much on advertising. Yeah, I've only ever said I wish I had spent more on advertising.
Now, where would you have spent it? Because these are primarily Amazon-based businesses, correct?
The businesses that I personally built, yes.
Right. So where would you spend that money?
We just identified the problem, because you said they were mostly Amazon-based businesses, right? So had I done things even better, I would have doubled down on non-Amazon advertising. Because if you're an Amazon business, which is like nails on a chalkboard to me, because it means you're dependent on somebody else,
right?
It means that you're dependent on this channel, and you've got to go double down on building a business that has a different leg to the stool. And now when you combine those things together, magic can happen. If you've got an email list of 100,000 people that you've built from cold advertising or from buying tripwires, and now you're combining that with the power of something like Amazon.com, that's really, really powerful. Most physical product sellers never make that pivot, or they get so myopic into one channel that they never spend the money and the time to go develop the advertising for another channel. I wish I had been comfortable losing my rear end on other advertising channels until I figured out those systems. It's interesting, Joe. It's true with every channel. You lose for a while, and then you figure out the systems. And then you start to grow through it and you get profitable. The strange thing is that most people, once they figure it out and get profitable, they're unwilling to go do that hard work in another area. So the way that Amazon worked in 2013, 14, 15 was, if you spent into the red long enough, you could outrank everybody else and go win. But I never, I lost that hustle when it came down to Facebook ads or influencers, and people start looking for the immediate ROI. In what business is there immediate ROI when you're building a long-term brand that has sales potential? Like, buyers are buying systems. They're buying profitable systems because you've already gone through that hard work of developing the systems that are profitable, but it requires you to go build them. So I wish I had spent more on advertising, been more willing to lay it on the line, rolled more back into reinvestment. So I'll call that mistake number three.
So for buyers and sellers that are listening, entrepreneurs that are listening, it's that one-legged stool, two-legged stool, three-legged stool. If you're 100% Amazon business, it's riskier than if you also have a revenue channel from Google AdWords and driving traffic to your Shopify store, and you might be doing wholesale or B2B, things of that nature. Right away, as I've said before, if you've got a business that's just doing $100,000 in discretionary earnings, it's 100% Amazon, same business, $100,000 in discretionary earnings, but you've got 60% Amazon, 25% Shopify, I guess that would be 15%, my math here, another percent of B2B, that business on the other side is going to be worth 15 to 20% more. So you might be breaking even or losing a little bit of money on that, you know, land grab, trying to grab more customers. But if you can turn that into even the same discretionary earnings, that business automatically is going to be worth 15 to 20% more, because the buyers will pay more for a risk-averse business. Mm. It's going to be around for the longer term. So very, very good advice. What channel would you go to first? Because there's so many options these days, and building a channel off of Amazon is hard, as you know. You've got to learn a whole new expertise. Where would you go first, and what do most of your successful folks do?
Yeah, I'm actually going to very creatively sidestep this question, because the obvious is Amazon. But where I would suggest is that people double down on where the audience is. To me, this is the nut that has to be cracked if you're building a sellable company. And what that means to me is, for some people, their audience hangs out following influencers. for other people, that is, they follow blogs or they have a blog where the audience is already hanging out. For some people, they've got a Facebook group where there's an audience. Now, what most businesses, especially like million-dollar businesses, are doing is they're going channel first and trying to extract as much of it as possible. Like, I'm going to go to Amazon, try to rank, and pull as much out of this pie as possible. Only a few people can win that game. But if you switch it and you say, where are my people? Who is the ideal buyer and where are they? Then the channel where you collect the order can always change. And that makes Shopify, Amazon, B2B a whole lot easier. The first nut that you have to crack is in where the buyers hang out apart from the sales transaction. And then you bring those buyers to the transaction. So the transaction, to me, Amazon, easy, no question. Put your product on Amazon. The credit card's already there. People are already looking for it. No question, easy, done. The nut that needs to be cracked is what happens one step before that. And if there is, like, if you don't have the influence, the list, the following, the traffic, the pay-per-click strategy, some way to go get those people and bring them into your ecosystem, I think you are struggling from the get-go. And that's the primary question that I ask the entrepreneur.
Yeah, and I think depending upon, as you say, the product and what they're offering, some of those different channels will make more sense. You know, I had a conversation with someone this morning that has several brands, and one brand has incredible numbers with email marketing, and that same expertise applied to that different brand doesn't do as well.
Right.
They're driving people to their Shopify store, though. Amazon keeps growing and outpacing everything else, though. So I understand, identify where your customers hang out, and then you've got to go find those customers. To own that list, though, you need to send them to your own store, not to Amazon. So are you sort of balancing between sending them to Amazon because it's all there, or?
No, I just disagree. So I think the loyalty to the brand is the customer experience, and you give the customer the ability to give you money wherever they are most comfortable making the purchase. I heard Brian Lee say once, Brian Lee is the founder of The Honest Company, you know, the billion-dollar brand with Jessica Alba. And I heard him say once that he considers it a win when the product is in the customer's home. That's when you've won. Not collecting it on my e-commerce site, not getting into retail. It's when the product is in the customer's home, however they get it. And you want as little friction as possible getting the product into the customer's home. You own the customer experience when you have their data. You have the ability to communicate a message in front of them. So if you've got the email list and you send them over to Amazon, Amazon rewards that.
Sure.
And your conversion rate's probably going to be higher sending them to Amazon than sending them to your Shopify store. So there's a balancing act here of, like, I know that I can get a higher immediate customer value sending them to my own website because I can put them through upsells and cross sells, get their immediate data, versus sending them to Amazon where I am going to have to work to get their data. I don't have any upsell experience. They might see a negative review. And so the entrepreneur is going to have to play the game of where the numbers make the most sense over the long term. But I think that the actual customer experience happens in where you communicate with them. And that's in the email message. That's in outside of just the transaction, not just where the credit card is being happened, but where it's being communicated.
Okay, I get it. And I'm just going to repeat it for those that are, well, not smarter than me. Let's put it that way. So it's capturing the customer information up front, building that relationship with them, and then simply send them to the place that they can buy the product and experience the brand with the least amount of friction and get it in their home.
Nailed it. Okay. Nailed it. That's my opinion.
And it all goes back, I would think, and it's kind of almost unspoken, that the brand has to be pretty amazing. So focus on that first. Build a great product, a great brand, so they have a great experience, and then do all that other stuff as well.
Yeah, and let me address that, because that often brings up the question, like, all right, how do I identify a brand? Like, what exactly is the brand? And the brand is the way that trust is communicated to a very specific customer. Most Amazon sellers have no idea who their customer is. They know what their product is. If you know what you sell and not who you sell to, you do not have a brand. Or you might have a brand that is really lousy. Right. Whereas if you know who the person is, it makes the product really, really easy. I was just meeting with one of my team members today. We were expressing the frustration over one of our brands in our portfolio because when we acquired it, it sold a lot of product, but it had no target market. And so we've had to do a lot of work to convert that brand into an actual brand that where people are not just buying a product, but they're buying something that says about themselves. Those businesses last. Product businesses don't, because they're commodities. People forget about commodities, and the minute that there's a better price or a better customer experience, their loyalty changes. But when you've got the brand, people are very stingy with their trust. And when they give it to you, you have them for as long as you keep their trust.
It's a very important message right there. Ryan, any thoughts in terms of whether someone should be building this business and always think about the future and possible exits? Do you try to instill in them that they should know the value of their business in the event they wake up someday and want to move on? Or do you just focus on building that brand and when you're ready, the time will come?
You know, the temptation for me is to say that no, you shouldn't be necessarily thinking about selling. But I know that I'm at a different spot than everyone who's listening. So I would say, like, if you're building this to make money, be building it to sell from day one. Because the very act of being in it for the money means that you will burn out. You will wake up and want to do something else. It's going to happen. So if that, and like, let's just be real about it. If you're in it because of the payday, build it to sell. Because that's what you're in it for. And the payday is the cherry at the end of the rainbow here. If you're in it because you've got a product you want to bring to the world, then still develop the systems and the processes that will keep you in the position to be in your zone of genius. And that will make you more sellable one day. But I don't think it's necessary for you to know what it's worth or be making decisions based on that. So these are different goals. Now I build companies that I'm excited about. And I am building them in the same way that would make something valuable, because I want to be in a position where I'm just in my zone of genius. But it's a different mindset than if I'm building something because it's going to be profitable. Does that make sense, Joe?
Absolutely. Excellent. Excellent. Hey, listen, I know we're running out of time here. I just want to say that last summer, I was at the Smart Marketer Conference and you got up and you spoke, as did another dozen or so very, very successful entrepreneurs. Each and every one of them had a PowerPoint presentation. And you got up there with nothing. And you talked for an hour. And the audience was captivated, as was I. You have a gift. Thank you for sharing it. Appreciate it.
I just got goosebumps. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
How do more people get to experience that and listen to you and hear what you do share?
You know, I'd love to answer that question. Can I offer one more piece of advice before we go?
You can offer a dozen more pieces of advice.
Wow, awesome. I'll leave it to one. But if you are in this to sell, please have a plan of what you're going to do with the money when you get it. Entrepreneurs and magicians, we make things appear out of thin air. We create value out of thin air. We create a bigger pie. We make money show up, and we also make things disappear.
Isn't that true?
And if you do not have a plan of what you're going to do with the money, it will slip through your fingers. I know you think you're the exception. I know you think all I have to do is invest this at 8% and I'm set for life. I know you think that's how it's going to be. You will blow the money. I know, right now, I just heard you think, no, I won't. Yes, you will. So if you don't have a net for catching the money and allocating the money for your lifestyle, you will be back in the grind very, very quickly. Promise you, I know you don't believe me. I'm here to tell you that's the case. Have a plan for what to do with the money once you get the money. It's actually my favorite conversation to have. At some point, I'll probably have workshops in my home about investing once you have a big windfall. But for now, just please, like, have a plan. And like, a plan would be better than no plan. And that plan would probably be best done after you've sat on the money for about 6 months and you've gotten used to that money being in the bank account. Your second question, or actually your only question, was
Can I interrupt? I definitely want to get to that. But in terms of the having the plan to exit, I'm always telling people, look, have your next adventure plan, because entrepreneurs, like you say, they blow through the money. It goes through their hands like sand. I'm often saying maybe get that other opportunity started and launched, as long as it's not competing, get the ball rolling so that you've got some working capital. Maybe you're going to put it in some of it, so you're not as bootstrapped, although you'll be more successful probably if you are. Do you think maybe they should 100% focus on what they're doing on that brand before they sell and up until the day they sell? Or maybe when it gets big enough and good enough and they've done enough right, they can take some of their attention and start brand B while they're selling off brand A.
Wow, Joe. The reason I'm saying wow is because my experience is pretty unique. And that was, I took about a week off and then I immediately went back into workaholism. And it was the worst, like, it was a horrible experience. Now, full disclosure, like at the same time, I was going through separation. I'm going through a lot of life changes. I threw myself into work right after the sale. I celebrated by reading books on my patio for like 8 days. And then I was immediately back to workaholism. And I roasted my body. I mean, I so needed a break. And I did not give myself that break. I don't know if every entrepreneur was as burnt out as I was. I was more burnt out than I even did.
Like, most ideal with hire. They come to me tired, exhausted, and ready to move on.
Joe, it's been over a year. I wouldn't even say I'm back now. I'm probably operating at 75% of capacity, like because I never really recovered. So should you go right back into it? I don't know. I think it depends on the level you're at and your own wiring. I make really good decisions when I'm relaxed and creative. I make terrible short-term decisions when I'm stressed. And when I'm in that workaholic mode, I'm a terrible entrepreneur. I wish I had just blissed out for like 3 months. I didn't.
I don't know what the folks that listen to you every week would do if you disappeared for 3 months though.
Well, here's the thing though, Joe. I kind of did. Like, my podcast sucked for like 3 to 6 months. And I was trying, like, I'm sitting in front of the mic trying to come up with things to say, and I was uncreative as heck. So I sort of did disappear.
Yeah.
It was just in a different way. And now I'm getting back to it, and it's a completely different experience. But I actually think I did my listeners a disservice by not taking a break. And if I had just been really upfront, be like, guys, I just got an 8-figure check. I am going to the beach and I will call you when I'm ready. My audience would have popped. But yeah. Instead, I was like, I'm operating from this place of like, oh my goodness, I'm so tired. And I turned off a lot of people. So I know that's not the answer that you expected. It's not the answer I expected.
No, I like it.
Hey, but I think it's true.
I think sleep and rest and meditation or whatever it is that folks do is absolutely necessary. So back to that original question and you know, finding out what they do with the money after they sell, how do they get more of Ryan Daniel Moran? How do they experience what that audience down at Smart Marketer and myself experienced when you just talked and everybody listened and took notes and all that?
Well, thanks so much, man. My media company is capitalism.com. My podcast is called Freedom Fastlane, and I say things into a microphone, and we hold events at capitalism.com that are specifically for entrepreneurs. And we just rebooted the Freedom Fastlane podcast. And I feel as though
with fresh energy.
What's that?
With fresh energy, right?
Well, yeah, I think you could probably feel it from me. 5 years ago, I started this journey as a boy. You know, I had just put everything I owned into my car, drove to Austin, Texas, started some new companies, and I documented the whole experience from startup to sale. And then I kind of grew up while documenting the journey. And now there's a new journey and it's a much bigger one. And so we just rebooted the kind of the entire audience, the whole experience in the podcast. So my podcast is called Freedom Fastlane. My company is capitalism.com.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure those are in the show notes. Love to see you be more successful on this new adventure, this bigger journey.
Thanks, Joe.
Let's stay in touch. I think I may see you at the Capitalism Conference at the end of August. We'll see. At the very least, we'll be to as many as we can be over the next few years.
Great to see you, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for your time, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.